hello, everyone, and welcome once again to another edition of the MMA Torch podcast. It is Thursday, February 25th, 2016. I am MMA Torch editor Jamie Penick, joined once again by Torch senior columnist Sean Ennis. Sean, how are you tonight?
I am rolling along through life. Every day is a holiday.
Today was my youngest second birthday, which I can't believe that 2 years has passed since that. I'm not sure where this time goes at this point, but you know exactly what I'm talking about on that front.
I do indeed. I had my daughter's birthday was a couple of days ago. My birthday was a couple of days before that. I had my 15th anniversary a few days before that. So it was it's been a busy week.
That's right. A belated happy birthday to you, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
We have a lot to get to today. It's been a bit of a newsworthy week. The last 6 days has been really interesting.
Yeah.
Bellator, unsurprisingly, scored record ratings on Friday night for Bellator 149 with the complete circus appeal of Ken Shamrock, Hoyce Gracie in 2016. And Kimbo Slice against something named Dada 5000. And I think records were expected. It was knocked out of the park as far as numbers were concerned. But we will have a further discussion here tonight as to whether or not, you know, you want that many people viewing your product when that's what you're presenting on a Friday night. But before we get to that, UFC Fight Night 83 results, UFC Fight Night 84 preview, we've got some BJ Penn talk on here tonight, some Alistair Overeem news. The big news of the week, Rafael Dos Anjos breaks his foot 12 days out from UFC 196, and we have a new main event for that card in Las Vegas next Saturday, and it might, on some levels, be even bigger than that fight, as crazy as it sounds. Conor McGregor is fighting Nate Diaz in a welterweight fight, and after the press conference they had in Los Angeles on Wednesday, I think it's safe to say that there's going to be plenty of people still interested in this fight. Sean, initial reaction to Rafael Dos Anjos and Diaz as the named opponent?
Wah, wah. Basically, you know, I'm not overly enthused by the replacement, you know, with Nate Diaz in there. You could obviously do worse. And at this point, I think it's in the UFC's best interest to get someone in there who is going to promote the fight pretty easily. And, you know, when you need someone to promote a fight easily, just call one of the Diaz brothers. So, you know, and it's certainly the added level of intrigue with this being at 170, although at the same time, it's not as though we're talking about an elite welterweight here with Nate Diaz, you know, who would typically fight at lightweight, has not done all that well at welterweight. But still, we'll get to see kind of how he would size up against a mid-sized welterweight if he is actually serious about getting in there with Robbie Lawler. Which, of course, he probably is serious about getting up with Robbie Lawler. Let's not act like Conor McGregor isn't serious about all the things he says, or at least all the things he says he wants to do. So yeah, I was really looking forward to that Dos Anjos fight. I think that was going to be really instructive as to how viable Conor McGregor is outside of the featherweight division. My hunch is that he would be pretty viable, though. You know, with how Dos Anjos has looked over the past, you know, 2 years, it would have been really, really intriguing to see what he could have done against RDA. So, yeah, I'm underwhelmed, but I do agree with you that I think this is not going to lose very much steam at all, if any.
From a pure sporting perspective, it's a damn shame we're not getting Conor McGregor against Rafael Dos Anjos, especially with the story of him trying to take a second title and proclaiming himself, you know, one of the best fighters in the world. If he had come in next Saturday and taken out Rafael Dos Anjos, holding two titles simultaneously, he's automatically leapfrogging some people in the pound-for-pound discussion and just further adding to his legitimacy. That said, from the spectacle aspect of the sport, and we saw it last Friday, this is the other end of the spectacle spectrum, and as good as you can hope for on that front. Because not only is it a circus-type feel, given Wednesday's back and forth between the two of them, but you have a legitimate fight anchoring that circus-type feel, as opposed to what we got from Kimbo Slice and Dafir Harris, as well as the main event at Bellator last week. So what we have here is Conor McGregor. It's the Conor McGregor show. And it's okay on some levels that this is being treated essentially as if hardware doesn't matter. Because, honestly, it clearly doesn't in this situation. There's no belt on the line. But from a money standpoint, from a pay-per-view buyer standpoint, this might be bigger than... I don't know if it's going to be, for sure. I think there was a major amount of significant intrigue in the two-division champion storyline. But at the same time, I think people, all of a sudden, are much more amped for March 5th than they were a week ago. It really felt like this was not anywhere near to the level of steam we had into McGregor Aldo in December. And a switch was flipped this week with this change, and Diaz is the perfect foil for Conor McGregor right now.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that. You know, I hadn't given thought to the fact that you're right. This fight didn't have the kind of steam that McGregor Aldo had, and RDA was not going to play the kind of game with McGregor that other fighters have. Nate Diaz is, as you said, the perfect opponent for a fight like this. If you want someone who's going to talk trash and not care what Conor McGregor says, Nate Diaz is your guy. Obviously Nate or Nick Diaz would be fine. This is and you're right. This is kind of the other end of the circus fight spectrum. You have the fights where, you almost don't want to watch because it's like, well, we'll talk about that later. But this is a fight that isn't necessarily, it's not necessarily the top of
it's not
the top
a meaningful
of the sport.
Fight for
right.
on,
that's,
on
yes.
most levels. It's
that's,
not
that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's not a meaningful fight on most levels, but it's kind of fun as hell. It's what it is.
Yeah, and it's not offensive.
No,
it's a decent enough matchup.
Diaz, the options that they legitimately considered, Jose Aldo and Frankie Edgar were out because Frankie is battling a torn groin, and Aldo was just cleared, I think, 5 to 10 days ago to actually train again after the knockout loss in December. So I think more than anything, his coach declined the fight before Aldo was even discussed, I think, before he was even, aware of the situation. And again, Dana White does some people dirty and throws them under the bus on SportsCenter by saying they wouldn't take the fight or whatever. But the legitimate guys considered for next week were Donald Cerrone, of course, Anthony Pettis, Nate Diaz. I think there was one more that I can't remember at this point, but I think...
Yeah, those are the three main ones anyway.
I think they made the right choice. I think Cerrone would have been interesting, but he did just get killed by Rafael Dos Anjos.
Yeah.
Nate Diaz didn't look particularly good against Dos Anjos when he fought him, but that was over a year ago, and he looked much better against Michael Johnson in December. So it's not two, 200th ranked fighters facing each other. It's the number one guy. Instead of fighting the number one guy at lightweight, he's fighting, what is Nate right now, 11, 10? He's fringe top 10. So it's not a fight that is illogical. It's a fight that could have been eventual anyway. And really, kind of the only shame about it happening on 11 days' notice is the fact that we don't have 3 months of what we got on Wednesday. Because,
well, you know, I think the other half of that is, I don't know if that would hold up for 3 months.
True. It might not.
Yeah.
But Wednesday was entertaining as hell. And they had I think they peaked at something like 230,000 streaming viewers at one point on YouTube watching a press conference from a UFC gym in Torrance, California. They had They had lines out the door at that UFC gym and down the block to get in to be a part of this, and they pulled this off on 10 hours notice. I mean, the UFC deserves a ton of credit for what they were able to put together on a very short amount of time here. And full credit to Diaz, who I think finally is getting the payday that he's wanted his entire UFC career. And full credit to McGregor for saying, I signed for a date, I'm showing up no matter who's against me. He's done this time and again. He says he's going to fight, he follows through. There's something... There's no shame in pulling out of fights. I'm an advocate for fighters if they're not prepared to not accept these types of fights. But on the other end of that, there is something admirable about McGregor's willingness to say, screw it, I will take on anyone who is going to be there that night.
Yeah, I think that's worth noting. You know, it's like you. You know, I think I advocate for fighters who are smart about their matchmaking. You know, and don't want to take fights on short notice, especially against guys who could be difficult style matchups. But at the same time, man, you have to admire the bluster of Conor McGregor, who says a lot of crazy stuff, but he backs everything up. There's nothing that he said that he's not been willing to stand behind, you know. And whether it's, you know, I'm going to win this fight or I'm going to fight whoever, whenever, he's done it. And, you know, love him or hate him, you got to admit the guy is impressive in that aspect, because not everybody does that.
And that's one of the reasons the UFC has been willing to go along with what he wants to do. Their willingness to allow him to take a 170-pound fight after he just won the featherweight title. Them even entertaining the idea of him going up to fight Robbie Lawler at UFC 200, which I think is still on the table despite this, is evidence of, you know, just his willingness to follow through on what he says he's going to do. There's obviously risk here. Nate Diaz, it's not a massive risk. Nate Diaz is a fighter stylistically who Conor McGregor probably should beat, despite Diaz being bigger, a little bit longer, tallest guy that McGregor's ever fought. But as good as he is, his style plays right into what McGregor does best.
Yeah.
Especially with how well McGregor has shown himself capable of working up timing on the feet against his opponents. So, like, what he did against Jose Aldo in 13 seconds was a complete timing move in 13 seconds. Like, he established things and set up a perfect strike off of the first two exchanges. And Nate Diaz is a guy who doesn't give a shit what's going on. He doesn't care. He wants the fights that seem to be bigger. This is the fight that seemed to be biggest, and it seems he's getting paid accordingly, which, that's fantastic. The UFC should, on 11 days' notice, be shelling out whatever someone would have demanded for that fight, and he gets to step in on what will be one of his biggest shows, and has a chance to play spoiler, because it is a setback for Conor McGregor no matter what weight class it's in if he loses, especially with how much he's said about how the weight classes don't matter and it doesn't matter because he feels he's the best fighter in the world. There's a setback if he loses this fight, but the risk is somewhat minor given the stylistic matchup here.
Yeah, and this is, you know, it's like you said, that this is more than likely the biggest fight that Nate Diaz is ever going to have. You know, I don't see him getting necessarily a title shot at lightweight unless some, I mean, obviously anything can happen. But even so, Conor McGregor is the biggest star in the sport right now. And, you know, debatable whether Ronda Rousey's up, you know, is may also be a bigger star. But whatever, either way, in the men's division, in any men's division, Conor McGregor is the biggest one out there. And this is kind of like, you know, it's interesting because it's a better fight than, you know, this is not unprecedented with champions moving up to fight it another way. You know, Anderson Silva did it against a few guys. But even with Anderson Silva, I think this is a better fight than something like Anderson Silva and James Irvin. Or Stephen Bonner even, you know,
it's right in line with Anderson Silva, Forrest Griffin after Forrest had lost the title. It's that style of fight. It's that level of fight.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the only thing that makes it, that takes a little bit of luster off it for me is that it's at welterweight when Diaz is not necessarily a natural, well, I guess weight-wise he is a natural welterweight, but he usually fights at 155.
But at the same time, you know, he at least has fought in that weight class several times. You know, he has some history there. What's really interesting to me about this? Just the speculation game with Conor McGregor is so much fun right now because there are so many possibilities.
Literally anything could happen.
Let's say he beats Nate next Saturday. Let's say with that win, he stays at 170, fights Robbie Lawler, and wins that fight at UFC 200. Nick is coming back in August. Nick fights at welterweight, has fought at welterweight from time to time. Nick wanting to get vengeance for his brother while fighting for the welterweight title after winning a fight in August. Sounds like one hell of a, you know, October-November style fight.
It'd be a pretty enormous fight. I mean, people, regardless of what happens with Nick Diaz, people love watching Nick Diaz.
I'm not going to lie. When Connor said on Wednesday, "I like Nick's little brother," and started laughing, that nearly killed me. That nearly killed me. I love that line so much. I like Nick's little brother. There was so much gold at that press conference from both of them. From McGregor coming up with stuff off the cuff, talking about Nick throwing gang signs with one hand and making balloon animals on the other for his work with the kids' jiu-jitsu classes. And then Diaz just saying, what was his line? They offered me a lot of money for the fight, and then I told him I want more of that shit. Come on, what do you think of that, mother? Just, there was so much gold in that press conference, and there's so much entertainment value between the two of them, both in the cage and out of it, in the lead-up to this, that, again, it's not a great sporting fight. It's not the best fight to be made. It's not the fight that proves anything about Conor McGregor above featherweight. It's not a fight that moves McGregor closer to his goal of being a multi-division champion. It's a complete placeholder on short notice that in some ways holds some things up if he's not going back to featherweight for his next fight either. But
as far as short notice placeholder fights go, you're not going to get much better.
Exactly. I mean, it's the only thing better was his last short notice placeholder fight when he had to fight Chad Mendes.
Right.
That was as good as it gets in that style of in that scenario, and this is a completely different take on it. I do feel for Frankie Edgar right now. It's especially given the fact that he was legitimately injured and unable to take the fight, but at the same time, he deserves more than 11 days to prep for that fight.
Yeah.
He deserves a full fight camp and a full lead-up because he's earned it, and to suggest otherwise is completely disingenuous on McGregor's part. For Aldo, for as much as, you know, I've talked about the fact that I think fighters shouldn't step in these situations if they don't feel they're ready. This one feels like one of those spots where if there was even the possibility of him being somewhat ready on a week and a half's notice, he probably should have taken the fight.
Right.
Because for Aldo, a win over McGregor, even at 155 with no belt on the line, means the rubber match is next for that featherweight title.
Exactly. Exactly. But no other fight is happening before that one.
Exactly. And without that, he's not fight. He might never get the McGregor fight. That's the thing. He might never get the McGregor rematch because McGregor, if he comes back to featherweight and defends that title at all, might be after an interim title fight is held. And I'm not convinced after Jose Aldo gets starched the way that he did that he beats Frankie Edgar a second time.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. And when you think about it, the fact that Jose Aldo, of all champions who have lost in the past couple of years, might not get a rematch at all, let alone
it's a damn shame. It's an immediate rematch.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Like how is Cain Velasquez scheduled to get an immediate rematch and Jose Aldo might never get one? How is Chris Weidman getting an immediate rematch and Jose Aldo might never get one? But that's insane.
That's the nature of the fact that, you know, McGregor starting down lower and going up in weight, and that there are so many interesting fights for him outside of the featherweight division is what makes that a reality.
Yeah.
And that's the case. If he can compete at 155 and 170 and feels better doing it than when he's cutting weight, so be it.
Yeah, that's what he's gonna do.
And again, it's you can have him drop the title, but it makes more sense to just have an interim champion and have that interim champion defend it until such time as McGregor decides to return.
The traveling NWA champion who eventually makes his way back down to your area and defends the title. Yeah, it's
it's the McGregor show. If you take the title from him, it's symbolic and means nothing. It's Daniel Cormier as champion. That's what that is.
Yeah.
And we're going to find out how that ends in April.
Yep. Well, so, I think we already have a pretty good idea of how that's going to end.
Exactly. But that's it's all it would be is a symbolic gesture that means absolutely nothing. And clearly the belts are not meaning much right now. With McGregor saying, the belts are nice. If the belts are there to rack up, I'll rack up the belts. But it's the checks that are more important, and I'll keep racking up the checks. Man, that man has a ton of quotable material.
He's got a gift.
He does. there's a reason. There is a reason he is in this spot. There is a reason that he is getting afforded these opportunities that no other fighter in UFC history has been afforded. And you can't say it hasn't been earned. And that's the thing.
Yeah.
So
it's like, you know, and the thing that's fun about it is that he does know it. You know, he knows he's the cash cow right now, and he plays that card every chance he gets, and it's actually pretty great.
It is. It is. He holds more power than any fighter who has come through the UFC. Honestly, he holds more power than Ronda Rousey did because Rousey wasn't flaunting it, and I think with her comments now, I think she felt an obligation to the UFC to fight three times last year, and that might not have been in her best interests.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I hope the UFC, for what it's worth, I hope that they are seeing that it's not such a bad thing to have a fighter that you need, you know, because they're still making a ton of money, you know.
Absolutely.
even though he's got leverage and can do whatever it is he wants to do, how great is it to have a star that will make you money every time you get him out there? So, like, if that's the case, why don't we start promoting more fighters and getting more people to where, you know, people know and like them?
Now, from a ticket sales standpoint, they kind of shot themselves in the foot on this one. They were a bit overzealous in trying to set it up for another significant live gate to the point of what they got in December with, I think, a little over $10 million at the MGM for 194. And so ticket sales have been slower for this one. You're not having as much travel 3 months after a ton of crazy Irishmen flooded the city of Las Vegas. So there's something to that, and they have to be smarter about their plans and look at the way that things are going, because while McGregor might be willing and ready to fight every 3 months, which is great for keeping things moving and getting the guys the fights that they deserve to get, you can't sell sell people on a $10 million gate and a million buys on pay-per-view every 3 months. It's not going to happen.
Right.
It's not going to. Every other fight, maybe the opponent is going to start to be a little more important than just the fact that it's a McGregor fight. I think he's going to continue to draw strong on pay-per-view regardless of who it's against, but having a more interesting opponent is going to help that out infinitely more. Obviously, UFC 200 is going to be massive. That one is selling itself regardless of what's on the card right now. Although, if they go that route and then have a massively underwhelming card, then we're going to have some issues. But that's still yet to be fleshed out. Right now, Conor McGregor, I think he's going to be good for at least 600,000 buys. Outside of that, I don't know how strong fight-to-fight it's going to be without key opponents. Next week, I think with Nate Diaz in there, honestly, right now, I'm the way that it seems, traffic-wise, attention-wise, the hype-wise, given the shift this week, that card could approach a million. I don't know that it's going to come anywhere close to that, but I think things have shifted enough attention-wise, and there's not nearly as much other sports that is going to be competition for it, that I think they're going to do significant numbers next Saturday in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think anything's out of the realm of possibility at this point.
Yeah. Speaking of massive numbers, Bellator 149, Friday night, Spike TV, from Houston, Texas. Live viewership before DVR averaged just under 2 million viewers for the entire broadcast. By far a record for Bellator. Their previous best for an event was just shy of 1.6 million for the Kimbo Slice Ken Shamrock headlined event last June. So, average start to finish, 9 p.m. through just past midnight Eastern, was just shy of 2 million viewers on average. For the Kimbo Slice Dada 5000 fight, 2.5 million viewers, peaking at 2.7 million viewers during that fight. Ken Shamrock, the 3 minutes of the Ken Shamrock-Hoyce Gracie fight averaged 2.4 million viewers. With DVR taken into account, the show peaked with 3.3 million viewers. With DVR, I believe it's watched within 3 days of the event. So that fight, 3.3 million viewers. By far, that is the biggest cable television number of the year. Dominic Cruz and TJ Dillashaw peaked, I believe, somewhere around, I want to say 2.6, 2.7. The average for that event was higher. It was a 2.2 million average viewership for the Fox Sports 1 broadcast. So up from what Bellator drew. But more eyes tuned in for the circus that was Kimbo Slice against the man born Dafir Harris. And the third fight between two men with a combined age of, well, I believe, 102. I don't know if you had a chance to read my editorial on Saturday about this, but
I did.
Okay.
I did.
The numbers were expected. They might be a little higher than some were expecting, but I think people were expecting a lot of people to tune in. This is exactly why Bellator put the fight on in the first place. It's why they put both of these fights on and gave them the attention they did, because they knew people were going to tune in because they were appealing to the, as Shamrock, or as Scott Coker put it, you know, the grandparents, the uncles, the lapsed viewers, the older viewers, the people who maybe used to watch and haven't watched. They're trying to get the average casual fan to get curious and tune in. Well, they got 2.7 million at its peak on Friday to sit through the single worst fight in televised MMA history. So is that really a benefit? That's the question. Kimbo Slice against Dada 5000 was one of the biggest embarrassments in televised cable MMA history, and it wasn't it was worse than anyone could have feared. It was that bad. This was a fight that hit the ground almost immediately between two guys billed as street fighters. It was billed as a street fight and not an MMA fight. You know, that's the way that they were hyping it up. And Kimbo Slice gets mount and does nothing. This was, what was the fight? It was in Strikeforce with Bobby Lashley and
The Gravedigger.
Yeah.
Right? What was his name? I can't remember.
It's not coming to me, but it was right in that vein where nothing happening. And Kimbo Slice gets stood up from the mount twice in this fight by Big John McCarthy of all referees.
Yeah.
McCarthy looked upset with both of them. He looked like he was pissed off in there. At one point, he separated them and I think literally shoved them both to separate and reset. He looked seriously angry that it was happening in front of him. Because this wasn't a fight. This was a war of attrition with just massive exhaustion almost immediately. Both guys were gassing because they had to get up and down off the canvas. And worse still, the finish comes in the third round, over 11 minutes into this fight, as Mr. Harris starts stumbling forward, veers off path without getting hit, and walks about 8 or 9 steps before face planting. And yes, it's you're laughing. It was funny. It was laughable. It was terrible. It was a train wreck. It was a car crash. And 2.7 million people were watching it. But worse still, Harris, the man himself, then needs to get stretchered out. His heart goes out at the hospital. He's in critical condition. I don't think he's been released from the hospital yet. He had renal failure, and his body shut down on him because he cut 40 pounds over a 2-month span to try to make the heavyweight limit. This is a guy who has not been competing as any type of legitimate MMA fighter. He hasn't had to deal with these types of weight cuts. He hasn't purported himself to be a legitimate MMA fighter. And yet the commission let him fight because they essentially do the eye test for dehydration. That's essentially what they admitted, was that they look at a fighter to determine whether or not they're dehydrated after a weight cut.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so he gets cleared to fight, and this is the end result. Kimbo himself needed to be held up for his post-fight interview. Like he could barely stand on his own. This was worse than the Houston-Alexander fight in the UFC.
Oh, yeah.
But for some reason, knowing what this fight represented, that many people still tuned in. And it encourages Bellator to keep putting on these types of fights, but honestly, it remains ultimately meaningless. If you look at the numbers without Kimbo Slice and Ken Shamrock, and then take out the Tito Ortiz Stefan Bonner fight. If you take out those three events, Bellator under Scott Coker is not doing any demonstrably different numbers than Bellator was doing under Bjorn Rebney over the final 18 months. And actually, if you look at the tentpole numbers, outside of the three major ones, the other three tentpole events that they've done the special stage and video packages and have hyped up, including the Dynamite show, the British Invasion, and there's one other that was in there, I believe, from St. Louis. All of those averaged, I believe, 876,000 viewers or less. Bjorn Rebney's era had five shows in the last 18 months of his reign that beat those numbers. So what we're looking at here is not any growth with Bellator outside of hitting a few peak things, because they're not getting any of the people tuning in for these fight cards to tune in for anything else that Bellator has to do. And I think you really have to be concerned about the fact that, yeah, you got massive numbers, but that many people saw what kind of product you put on Friday night.
Yeah. I don't understand. My first thing is, when I saw these ratings, what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, you've got people that watch Bellator every week. And I get that. MMA fans, hardcore people, love watching MMA. Great. No problem. Who makes up the difference between the regular Bellator viewers and the over 2 million people who watch this? Like, who is not a regular viewer, hardcore fan of MMA, and then says, well, Shamrock versus Gracie, that fight definitely happened 20 years ago. I got to see that. Or
the Kimbo Slice versus... The people who haven't tuned in for this MMA thing for 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think that, like, you see this is on the docket, and you say to yourself, aren't those guys like 50 years old now? And yes, they are. So why are we doing this? You know, but for some reason it continues to click. And, you know, I do not have a problem with circus fights. You know, Pride was built on the back of circus fights. But the difference is, Pride had things to back it up. They had Vanderlei Silva going out there and killing tomato cans for a minute. You know, besides the circus fights, they had Fedor going out there and doing crazy things. You know, they're building up guys as they're getting eyeballs on the product by putting circus fights out there. And really, the circus fights really probably appealed more to the Japanese audience than they did to the audience overseas. You know, especially when you're talking about getting stand-up comedians and actors in there with legitimate fighters. But you know, people would tune in for those, and they would see Fedor, they would see Vanderlei Silva, they would see Alistair Overeem. They'd see, you know, all these different guys. I mean, Pride had a gigantic stable of great fighters that they were putting on showcase in addition to these crazy fights. And that is what Bellator is lacking, because, you know, it shows on this card. What else was even on this card? They had Melvin Gillard getting knocked out. By whom? Who knows who Derek Campo is? Nobody. You know?
This is something that ties into this conversation here, but it's really interesting to see how far down MMA viewership has come. Because if you go back to some of the UFC's events on Spike, if you go back to September 16th of 2009 specifically, Nate Diaz against the aforementioned Melvin Gillard peaked at 2.9 million viewers on Spike.
Wow.
That's the type of fight that used to bring that viewership to Spike.
Yeah.
Now we get Kimbo Slice well after... And really, Kimbo is still diminishing returns, even though this number is technically higher than the Shamrock one. I mean, he did nearly 5 million viewers for the Ultimate Fighter finale.
Yeah.
He did, 4.5 million viewers on CBS. He's been a part of massive numbers. Kimbo Slice is a draw. Regardless of how bad he is as a fighter, people still want to see him fight. Okay. But it's...
That's the only reaction I can have is, okay.
But it doesn't mean that they're going to tune in for your product otherwise.
Right. And that's the problem. That's the problem. Is now, Bellator, instead of being the guys who got you to tune in with Kimbo Slice and got you to stay for, you know, Marcus Galvao or whoever, they're the guys who put on the Kimbo Slice fight, you know? And they're the guys who put
just,
on the Tito Ortiz fight.
The philosophy doesn't make sense to me.
It's not sustainable.
It's not. And it's like they make a move where... It was such a jarring tonal shift after the event on Friday, because we went from that circus to a full hour-long thing about Benson Henderson. There couldn't be a fighter further from Kimbo Slice than Benson Henderson.
Yeah.
And just on a respectability, legitimate talent standpoint for this roster, and not only that, but yeah, they pick up Benson Henderson, but they're also the organization who had apparently no interest in Aljamain Sterling whatsoever, are gearing up to let Will Brooks walk, didn't sign Alistair Overeem, didn't even attempt to, and also signed Josh Koscheck and Josh Thompson and Chris Lieben in the last year.
Yeah. I mean, those things...
They're going for the names that Spike knows, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And that kind of has to reflect on their philosophy. I mean, at the end of the day, they're not building new stars. They're putting old stars out there to do whatever it is they could possibly do, which is not much.
Well, and if the idea is to, you know, try to build up some other names by putting these past names on top, to get them to tune in the first place, they're doing a piss poor job of not only their planning, but then in retaining those viewers.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, Friday was the worst example of this because like you said, they had nothing on the undercard. Melvin Gillard getting starched in the third fight from the top means nothing.
Yeah.
Linton Vassell and Emmanuel Newton again.
Right.
Emmanuel Sanchez is a nice project right now. He's coming along strong. He looked solid against Daniel Pineda. He's been pulling off some upsets, and he's a guy who now has won 5 of his 6 fights in Bellator. You know, he's only got 2 losses. He's a 25-year-old. He's the type of guy you can start to build around, but he's on the opener of a card that people were only tuning – again, if this event averaged just under 2 million and so many tuned in the final 40 minutes or whatever, that means they weren't tuning in earlier in the night, so it didn't matter.
Yeah.
They didn't see this in the first place. And it's – there's nothing in the Scott Coker model right now that seems to be – legitimately about changing things for the better, and it's kind of a shame because I was very much championing the move from Bjorn Rebney because things had gotten stale and they were on a downturn, and I think it's easy for us looking back on Strikeforce and the fact that it wasn't necessarily as bad as we ripped on it at the time, and there was a lot of really good fighters who came out of that. At the same time, what we're seeing from Scott Coker now in Bellator is further justification of the criticisms that Strikeforce received at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, you almost have to wonder at this point, like, was all that success by the fighters after Strikeforce folded an accident? You know? I mean,
I don't
think
it was. I think they're the nature of this sport means that you're going to have elite talent that the UFC doesn't snatch up right away or doesn't recognize right away. And that doesn't necessarily mean that whomever is hosting them at the time has done anything right. It just means that they were on the wrong platform for their talents at the time.
Yeah. Very true.
Yep.
Yeah. It's all just very strange to me. You know, it's, It's like we've talked about. We've talked about Bellator several times with these crazy fights they put on. And for a while, it seemed to me like, I get it. I get what you're doing, Bellator. But now I don't see it. I don't see what the benefit is long term. Are we just like, is Coker just thinking, I'm going from event to event here. I'm trying to make it from week to week, or is he really trying to actually build something? Is he being hamstrung by the Viacom guys? I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's very strange.
I doubt it's the latter because this is also the same man who is once again wanting to promote kickboxing and is bringing the Bellator brand to kickboxing starting in April. And so we're going to see some events that have it. It's one of those things where he argued before last Friday's event, we can have something for everything. We can have something for everyone. We can have that. These events can have something to appeal to everyone, and that can be done. Well, I don't know that that's the truth.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have at least some section of your fan base from whatever side of the sport you're coming into who says, okay, I really like the circus fights, but I don't like the rest of MMA. I don't really care for that, so I'm not going to tune in for that. Or you're going to have the fans who vehemently despise those circus fights and then don't want to tune in for those and then might not support your product for the others. And or when you're bringing kickboxing in, you're going to have kickboxing fans who don't stick around or MMA fans who don't stick around for kickboxing. It's you can throw everything against the wall. It doesn't mean that it winds up being satisfying for you can think that you have something for everyone, but instead it winds up being a product that doesn't necessarily appeal to anyone at all.
Yeah. No,
And
I yeah.
yeah.
I see. It
Sorry, I
pretty
didn't
much,
mean
no,
to.
you're fine. It pretty much says it all. It just, I think we're wallowing in the incredulity that we both kind of have for the
Well, I
situation
mean,
that they're in right now.
let's look at what they've got coming up here. It's tomorrow night was supposed to be a bantamweight title fight a week after, but it was already getting it gets lost in the shuffle when you're coming a week after an event that does however many million viewers and you're not doing a very good job of establishing the fact that hey, we also have fights next week and the week after.
Yeah.
Because that was not a major part of that broadcast. There was
Right.
more time spent on many other things than there was on the fact that hey, we've got a title fight next week and some other fights coming up. But now tomorrow's card lost the title fight, Marcos Galvão out with an illness. So Chet Congo is in the main event. And we've got
Yeah.
David Rickles and Kendall Grove on this card. There's not much tomorrow night on Spike. Next week we've got Joe Warren fighting again against Darian Caldwell, which in some respects is a really interesting fight because Caldwell is a rising former wrestling star fighting the old guard former wrestling star, and that's there's some interest there. Bubba Jenkins against Goity Yamauchi is a really interesting featherweight fight. I talked to Bubba this week actually. I'll have something on that next week leading into the event. But then you go into April, we've got Pitbull Freje, the less talented Pitbull Freje, taking on
Pitbull number two.
something named Brent Primus in Italy as part of that multiple the MMA slash kickboxing events. Ben Henderson making his debut the week after that against Andrei Koroshkov is a legitimately somewhat intriguing welterweight fight, but I'm more interested in Ben Henderson against Will Brooks and Michael Chandler and the other lightweights on the roster. And then you go into May, and they have two legitimately interesting fights. King Mo against Phil Davis and Josh Thompson against Michael Chandler. Those are two really interesting fights that are
Yep.
going head to head with the next UFC heavyweight title fight. Like, come the f on. Like that's how this is going down. Because that it's May 14th. Yes, they are in California and they're on free cable television. The UFC has Fabricio Werdum fighting and Jacare against Belfort in the co-main. I'm sorry, that pay-per-view wins out.
Yeah.
This is what Bellator is presenting. They don't have these types of fights that they don't have enough of the Shamrock Gracies and Kimbo Dadas. Oh man, it kills me to even say it. I don't know if you read my report on Friday, but I had to change his name multiple times throughout it because no one was taking it seriously, so I figured, why should I?
So I may have missed something in the interim because I don't care about Bellator all that much, quite honestly. But didn't Scott Coker say when he came on that they wouldn't be running weekly events?
It's really not weekly. They just happen to have three in a row for some reason, and I'm not sure why they're doing it that way.
I mean, I feel like if Bellator were to run like four or five events a year and let their guys take fights outside the organization from time to time, that they could put on some really decent cards. But,
well, they did cut it down to 16 last year, but now they're ramping it back up. So I don't know.
I don't get it. But you know, what do I know?
Well, that Friday event was not the only cable MMA on the weekend.
Now, Wilson's the fighting coming from a high school gym, baby.
Man, Marlon Marais busted up some dude's leg 50 feet from a volleyball tournament.
Man, I'm telling you though, I will say this. I don't care where you are. If you're winning a fight by leg kicks in the first round, you are a bad man.
Marlon Moraes is great.
He is a bad
man. I wish he was
man.
Not fighting for World Series of Fighting.
Yes. Yes. Get that man a stage.
As
he is
as,
a beast.
As bad as Bellator was on Friday night, it might be equally as embarrassing that WSOF put on an event on cable television where you could clearly see the volleyball tournament in the background from the rec center. Come on. Even the regional shows here are kind enough to rent out their own ballroom. Like they at least think that far ahead.
It's true. It's true. Do an armory or something, you know. It's not that hard.
That's just – that looks as low rent as you could possibly get for – a televised event. It looked terrible on TV.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. I'll tell you, the non-UFC is kind of a wasteland right now. Like, you know, the domestically, anyway. You know, you've got...
Lower-end UFC is kind of a wasteland right now.
Yes,
we're getting
yes.
to that in just a second here, but...
And I don't know when this happened. Or like, I mean, obviously with the expansion and how many events are going on with all the promotions now is really when the product started to dilute itself. But how did we get here?
The problem is there's so much great MMA even today. There's so much talent in the sport. There are so many extremely good fights. There's more talent in this sport in the top 100 of every division. Let's throw it that out. Maybe not 100. Top 50 of every division, at least. There is more talent in the sport in that amount of fighters than there's ever been. And the problem is we're seeing fights with...
The top 1,000.
Thousands upon thousands of fighters from multiple different promotions. It's still kind of mind-boggling to me that it was just like 5 years ago we were... lobbying to see every fight on a card.
Yeah, it is crazy, isn't it?
I kind of long for the days where the prelims are not televised.
You know, it's funny because we were lobbying for that at the time, but at the time George St. Pierre was fighting on untelevised prelims.
That's also true. There is that. Well, they also had a lot of 8 and 9 fight cards.
Yes,
I've been saying this for the better part of the last 2 years. The UFC could easily
cull
the bottom 200 on their roster, switch to 8 or 9 fight cards, and they could still run 40 events a year.
Absolutely.
That would be,
and it would
so,
be
much,
so much better.
It would be so much better than we got 13 fights on Sunday. 13 fights
no
in a card
that
was already ravaged by injury, so several of them were extreme late replacements or fighters who really didn't necessarily belong there, and it's not necessary.
No.
It's not. the UFC events, they're really fun to attend live. People don't need to be at a live sporting event for 6.5 hours.
Yeah, and that's not an exaggeration. If you've never been to a live UFC event, it's 6.5, 7 hours.
That's
if you go to the whole thing.
And especially when you have these FS1 cards where they purposefully drag things out
and
delay things for commercial breaks and have to fit everything
go
in. It's so long. Like NFL games, they're a 3-hour time commitment. Yeah, you might watch NFL all day, but you're not at a game for 3.5 hours. You could tailgate ahead of time and make a day of it, whatever. That's different than being in the arena and trying to sit through everything. Yeah. And
waiting 20 minutes between fights.
Waiting 20 minutes between fights and all of that. And there's no other sporting event that requires that kind of time commitment, and it's not necessary. They could do so much more with 4.5 hours. Part of it is they're beholden to too many masters.
Right.
They want to get prelims on Fox Sports 1. They want to get prelims on Fight Pass. They want to get their main cards wherever they're supposed to be. But we certainly don't need 5 hours of televised fights these days.
Yeah.
If you want to put them on Fight Pass and have them available, okay. But the fans in the arena don't need that many fights. You have so many who don't show up until an hour or two into the card so that they only get there for the main card.
I can't blame them anymore. It used to be that we would watch these cards and you'd sit there and watch a card in Vegas and the prelims are going on with great fighters and you're thinking, man, these jerks don't even show up for the good fights on the undercard. And now it's like, man, nobody's there and I don't even blame them.
With Sunday's event, if you would have missed everything except for the last 5 fights, you would have only missed one really good women's fight on the Fight Pass prelims, and that's it.
Yeah,
a couple of finishes, okay, whatever. Even on the main card.
Not significant, even though they're good finishes.
Even on the main card, you know, for as much as I was impressed by Dennis Bermudez controlling Tatsuya Kawajiri, that was an eminently skippable fight.
Yeah.
There was a lot to like on Sunday on the UFC Fight Night 83 card from, where were they? Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yeah. First event in Pittsburgh in nearly 5 years. The last one was – do you remember the last one?
No, sir.
It was the event that Nate Marquardt was supposed to fight Rick Story.
Oh,
and
man.
Pittsburgh. It was the dawn of the testosterone replacement era. This was the one of the first times that we had heard of this being a thing that he had been allowed to, but then didn't get his levels up correctly and because of that got scrapped – got fired, and we ended up with what was legitimately a entertaining, if still completely messed up, fight between Pat Barry and Chet Congo.
That's true.
But back to Sunday. Donald Cerrone returns just 2 months after getting starched by Rafael Dos Anjos, comes back at welterweight, supposed to fight Tim Means. Tim Means goes out with a failed drug test. Alex Oliveira steps in. He equated himself well for the first minute. He was actually getting the better of the striking exchanges in the first part of this fight. Cerrone actually had to kind of slow himself down, cover up a little bit. Then he scored a really nice takedown, easily passed into mount, scored a mounted triangle, turned it over, and Oliveira tapped right away. Mario Yamasaki missed the tap right away, and Oliveira tapped several more times until he stopped it. That was just the second of two significant screw-ups on Yamasaki's part in a three-fight stretch. We'll get to the other in just a second here. But Donald Cerrone gets back on track. I think this is the role that Cerrone's going to be in for now. He's not... I doubt he ever challenges for a title again, but he's going to continue to be a fun fighter, enjoyable fighter to watch, and he's going to get fights that are entertaining, and this was one of them.
Yeah, that topside triangle was a thing of beauty. Moved into it quickly, and that... Yeah.
It's easy to forget how good he is on the ground.
He's tremendous. He's tremendous on the ground. I mean, it was just like the way he set that up and executed it was perfect. It was just perfect, flawless. And and like you said, it was. I can almost understand how Yamasaki missed that tap just because it was so fast. Like it was.
Yeah, it almost didn't look like the hold was all the way on when he tapped.
Yeah. He was tapping immediately once Cerrone went to his back, and it was although it was kind of entertaining to watch Cerrone point at it, like, hey, this is happening right now, in case you're wondering. But yeah, there's not a whole lot to say about it. It was a quick fight, but Cerrone, seems to be back to, taking fights whenever, wherever, and just clowning lower level guys, which is great.
Let's talk about Derek Brunson because he's quietly becoming one of the better middleweights in the sport right now. He took out Juan Carnero in 2.5 minutes, looked very good doing so. It's his third straight TKO victory. He has 4 wins in a row. His only UFC loss came against Yoel Romero. He only has 3 career losses, though a split decision loss to Kendall Grove in 2012 is a eh. It's not a great look. The only other loss, other than Romero, is a knockout to Jacare Souza. Losing to two of the best middleweights in the world, especially with one of them happening in 2012, in what was really one of his first featured fights, given he had been, relegated to the Challenger Series in Strikeforce, it's not a bad look, is what I'm saying. In the UFC, he's 6-1, the only loss to Romero. He has stopped 4 of those 5 opponents, and against Ed Herman, Sam Alvey, and Juan Carnero on Sunday, he's looked damn good doing so. Derek Brunson is someone who needs to be taken seriously.
Absolutely. Juan Carnero was on quite a streak coming in here. I think he'd won like 6 in a row going into this fight. Sam Alvey was pretty hot going into his fight with Derek Brunson, and Brunson smoked him. Even the fight with Yoel Romero, if I remember correctly, I think Brunson was winning that fight for a good bit of it. And
Early on, yeah, and it was a fight of the night winning performance despite a third round loss, so.
And that was one of those ones where Yoel Romero just remembered that he is just an incredible athlete and just did crazy things.
He ate his spinach after the second round.
But yeah, I absolutely agree. Derek Brunson is a beast and needs to be a guy that we're watching. I mean, Juan Carnero is no joke, and Brunson just destroyed him, made him look silly, which I'm hoping that he gets a marquee fight or at least close to a marquee fight next time out.
Cody Garbrandt was supposed to fight John Lineker on this fight, and sadly, Lineker had to drop out because of contracting dengue fever. Garbrandt took on BJJ ace Augusto Mendez. Legitimately, Mendez is, there's a lot of talk about, world champion jiu-jitsu guys in this sport. Mendez is one of those black belt level, multiple black belt level jiu-jitsu world champions, as legit as they come on the ground. On 11 days' notice, having to cut almost 30 pounds, he did not have a great showing in his debut. Garbrandt stopped him with a really nice sequence. It wasn't a great fight up until the finishing sequence in the first round, but Garbrandt got a nice win, remains 8-0, looking ahead to the John Lineker fight getting rebooked. At 24, Garbrandt is coming along as he should at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. The definition of a young up-and-coming prospect. Would have been really nice to see him fight John Lineker. But like you said, I think that's a great matchup, and hopefully that does happen down the line here, because that would be a really a tremendous fight.
The only other thing of note on the main card was, I suppose surprisingly enough, Chris Camozzi, who in his 15th UFC fight finally secured a post-fight performance of the night bonus. He had never won a fight night bonus in 15 UFC fights. He takes out Joe Riggs in 26 seconds. I really like this finish from Camozzi, at least. Riggs is clearly shot, but you have to give Camozzi credit for what he did because he rocked him with a perfect jab and then just unleashed hell with knee after knee after knee after knee. Riggs is covering up and blocking much of it, but it, to his detriment, because one of them broke his forearm, and then the next one got through to his jaw and put him to the ground. So Kamosi does a ton of damage in 26 seconds and takes home a well-earned extra $50,000.
That was quite a sequence for Kamosi. I mean, really good Joe Riggs. I believe Joe Riggs, you know, I'm not sure why the UFC, but, you know.
Apologies to our listeners, as we've had some technical difficulties this week, and Sean was cut off and unable to get back on the call. So that will conclude this week's podcast without us hitting a couple of the topics that we had planned on, including our preview for Saturday's event from London with Anderson Silva against Michael Bisping, Gegard Mousasi against Talis Latis, Tom Breeze against Keita Nakamura, and Francisco Rivera against Brad Pickett. Also, we were going to touch on the BJ Penn sexual assault allegations that came out this week from his former editor-in-chief at bjpenn.com regarding an incident involving said editor Pedro Carrasco's girlfriend. That has led to an actual police investigation, and Penn's impending return to the UFC being delayed. So that has had some significant consequences, and we'll probably have more to say on that as more information comes out. But we will have live coverage on Saturday of the UFC Fight Pass event. We'll have quick results and commentary on the prelims, as well as a full round-by-round report for the four-fight main card on UFC Fight Pass on Saturday afternoon. Our own Dan Moore will be live in the arena as a credentialed member of the media out there at UFC Fight Night 84 at the O2 Arena. He will handle the Twitter account at MMA Torch for us, with live coverage from inside the arena throughout the event. So make sure to follow that and follow along with our live report Saturday night. And we will be back hopefully next week with some of these issues figured out. So I want to thank you all for listening in. For Sean Ennis, once again, this is Jamie Penick signing off.